Hi, everyone. Let's get started. I'm Fahad Malik, a senior actuary at EML. For those who don't know, EML stands for Employers Mutual Limited, a leading claims management and workers' comp insurance provider in New South Wales. My expertise spans across pricing, reserving, budgeting, and capital modeling. Previously, I was working in consulting, so I've worked with a diverse range of organizations, including insurance companies, compensation schemes, and various government and financial institutions. I'm also in process of completing a PhD, and today I'm here to present a slice of my research work. So the topic of my research, as well as today's presentation, is modeling solutions for the home insurance availability and affordability crisis in flood-prone regions of Australia, an introduction to CGE technique. Basically, CGE, or Computable General Equilibrium Modeling, is a reliable and useful tool to understand the economic impacts of climate change. Basically, we establish scenarios that can be modeled for policy analysis up to the year 2100. So let's get started. We'll kick off with an overview of catastrophes for the last three financial years. Between July 21 and June 22, these natural catastrophes cost the insurance industry nearly $6.4 billion, predominantly by floods. So you're not well aware of the size of these catastrophes. The present government has invested $300 million every year in flood mitigation measures. But if you compare $300 million every year with $6 billion worth of flood damages in one single year, then we are still a long way off the mark. In fact, an average household back in 2022 paid nearly $1,500 in terms of direct cost arising from these floods, which is expected to grow to 2,500 by 2050. So the direct cost is huge, as well as the overall economic cost of these floods is anticipated to reach $35 billion by 2050. So if this does not drive us, I don't know what will. Interestingly, Australia is the largest, driest inhabitant continent on Earth. So it is somewhat ironic that these floods are the most destructive and the most catastrophic events we have faced so far. I don't think I need to tell anyone in this room that climate is changing and Australia is absolutely on the front line of this threat. But at the same time, there's some good news. The present government has made some real step change with the parliament. They have started, programs like invest in renewable energy projects, investment infrastructure like levees and dams, and they've also started programs like buyback, home elevation. They've also set up legislative targets for 2030 and 2050. That being said, we have a long way to go. All right, let's quickly talk about the previous wet periods. So back in 2011, nearly 70% of the Queensland was flood declared, and parts of Victoria were also severely flooded. So technically, we had two states that had same level of flooding that we experienced back in 2022. Then in 1974, several parts of Australia got severely flooded, including Northern Rivers, Brisbane, Murrumbidgee. And then if you step back, in 1880s, we had two terrible floods in Brisbane, something we had never seen before, and just 2 weeks apart. If you closely look at this picture is from, these pictures are of Queensland Navy base ships. So basically, the floods actually washed away these ships and they ended up in the botanical garden. People were wondering how were they going to get these ships out. But after 2 weeks, the second flood took place and brought the ships back into the ocean where they belong. So if the second flood wouldn't have taken place, those ships would have still been sitting there as monuments or something like that. So the key message here is that floods sort of come in a cluster. Sometimes we have got really bad years, really, really bad years. Then we get a bit of a break and then we all forget, especially the politicians. This is an interesting chart. It shows the flood history in Hawkesbury starting from 1790 all the way down to the recent years. So, of course, on the horizontal axis, we have got the individual years, and on the vertical axis is the recorded height of the flood. If you closely look at the periods that are highlighted in orange, these periods are 30 to 40 years long. During this period, nothing happened. Not a single catastrophic flood took place. It's like an entire generation forgetting about floods. Then at the same time, if you look at the periods highlighted in blue, that's where we had some of the most catastrophic floods hitting 14 meters of 16 meters height. If you look at the recent floods, in 2020, we hit a height of 9.4 meters. In 21, roughly 13 meters. And in 2022, we actually had two floods hitting 14 meters. So the key message here is, like, I don't know whether we have entered into the same period again, but it does seem like history is repeating itself. We have specifically focused on Cat 221 or March 22 floods that took place in Southeast Queensland and parts of New South Wales. This Cat event cost the insurance industry over $5 billion in losses. Despite the enormity of this disaster, the insurance companies managed to settle nearly 80% of the reported claims, that is roughly 240,000 claims in less than 2 years. That's a remarkable effort by Australia's insurance industry. This shows their resilience, strength, and commitment towards the society. They quickly got in touch with state and federal governments and various councils and other institutions to assist the impacted members of the community. The important message is that the cost of building infrastructure, damaged and washed out homes, is substantial. Therefore, the government as well as the insurance companies play an absolutely critical role in the recovery process and as well as it requires support of the wider community. This chart shows the economic cost in the top 10 affected LGAs by the March 22 or the Cat 221 flood. If you look at the vertical column, it denotes the incurred cost. The human icon shows the incurred cost per capita, and the dollar icon shows your average claims cost. If you talk about in terms of the incurred cost, then clearly Brisbane took the worst hit. It had an insurance bill of $1.4 billion, followed by Lismore, Moreton Bay, Tweed, and so on and so forth. However, if we talk about in terms of averages, then clearly Lismore stands out. It has got the highest average cost per capita and average claims cost. For those who don't know, Lismore is a small town with a population of less than 50,000. Nearly 500, I think close to 1,000 houses were nearly damaged and destroyed, and several houses were also like severely damaged. So the average cost of construction or the replacement of a house is about $300,000 to $400,000. So you can well imagine why these averages are so high for Lismore. Based on these high averages, we decided to focus specifically on Lismore. And not to mention, Lismore faced the worst home insurance affordability and availability crisis in the recent years. This chart has been taken from Lismore City Council Journal. This chart actually shows, like, that's actually the Lismore downtown, the Lismore CBD. And on your right is the Lismore CBD that is completely washed out by the March 22 floods. If you look at the height, it's close to 14.5 meters. That's massive. That's incredibly beautiful. Like, for a flood with a height of, 14.5 meters. This chart shows the history of flood events in Lismore. Starting from 1870 all the way down to the recent years. On the vertical axis, we have got the recorded height of the flood. If you look at this zigzag line, that's the height of the levee. That is about 10.5 meters. Historically, there have been about 6 or 7 floods that have been above the height of the levee. So that's what is classified as a catastrophic flood. And if you look at the March 22 flood highlighted in red over here, the height is about 14.5 meters, well above the height of the levee, as well as well above the height of the previous historical floods. When I say it's beautiful, I mean in a bad sense. Like, it's nature's marvel, right? I'm like that's something we had never seen before. I think it wasn't even projected It's definitely clearly a once-off event, but yeah, it had a catastrophic impact on the infrastructure and the insurance bill. Whilst we were doing this research, we also found severe variability in home insurance premium offered by various insurance companies in the Lismore market. We conducted a shadow shopping exercise to confirm it, and we found that two houses with similar market structure, similar market value, the insurance companies were quoting between $5,000 to $37,000. It does ring a bell, right? There's just too much variability in the quoted premium. So it does seem like the home insurance industry in Lismore is unable to price the billion-dollar risk. And even if you look at the scatter plot, the quoted premium is all over the place. There's just no relation. I've been in the industry for about 6 or 7 years, have closely worked with various home insurers. So to some extent, this variability is justified because each insurer has got its own goals and motives, different risk appetite. They have got various rating factors, offering different coverages, different level of excess and sum insured. Different pool size, different level of risk concentration. So there are heaps and heaps of factors that is driving this variability. Home insurance affordability and availability is a critical issue being faced by the Australian economy. However, there's no silver bullet. Just no silver bullet. So basically, what the government can do, it can adopt some flood mitigation measures like investing in resilience, improving building quality standards, better land planning, removing state taxes from insurance premium, mitigation dams, and various other levers. So the question arises how to assess the effectiveness of these individual flood mitigation measures. That's where we employ CGE or computable general equilibrium technique to understand the social cost and social benefits of each of these measures. Before I jump onto the next slide, maybe I can share a thought. So basically, we generally assume these flood mitigation measures, like their goal is to reduce flood damages. But the main goal or the primary goal is to save people's lives. But we Australians are not good at evacuation. We just don't follow rules. We tend to stay at the high-risk flood-prone region and tend to verify things ourselves. We think we are better than the officials. But if you look at some of the best European countries, people are allocated their buses stops and they all will be there. No one will be going back to bring their cats. They bring their cats with them. So the key message here is that no matter what flood mitigation measure is adopted by the government, in order to make it fully effective, it requires support of the wider community. So what is computable general equilibrium modeling or CGE? It is used to answer counterfactual type questions. CGE modeling is a powerful tool for tracing through the economic linkages between sectors and show how impacts play out over time. CGE modeling is a versatile tool for policymakers, economists, researchers, and very soon, I hope, after this presentation, actuaries would be motivated to adopt CGE modeling into their skill set. It is not a projection tool, but a simulation tool. Basically, we compare Australia's economy under general condition or baseline condition, and we try to change some of the conditions or add some shocks into the economy. In simple words, we try to answer what if type questions. How would be Australia's economy impacted if the government starts an infrastructure project like building a tunnel? Or giving subsidies to Teslas, EVs in general, or simply removing levies from home insurance premium, how would it actually affect the Australian economy and its various sectors? So in a nutshell, CGE helps us understand how the economy has performed in the past. It helps us answer or find out if something's important to the economy at present and how the economy will perform in the future. So that's the sort of questions are tackled by CGE modeling. We have used CGE modeling to understand the impacts of climate change on Australia's economy. For instance, when flood strikes Lismore, there's an is a significant damage to public infrastructure, homes, and severe loss of income activity. So that has got a negative impact on GDP. But at the same time, government started some programs like building homes for the flood victims, home elevation programs, buyback programs. So that actually led to a construction boom. People from different towns, the nearby adjacent towns, started coming down to Lismore for better job opportunities. So that's the sort of analysis we do using CGE. It helps, it gives you flexibility to model Australia at a national level, state, or more granular basis under SA2 and SA3 regions. We can also run analysis based on industries like manufacturing, agriculture, construction, and so on and so forth. You can also run analysis by property type and by the risk type. So we have applied CGE to produce a projected path for economic output that aligns to reflect a decided representative concentration pathway, RCP, range between 4.5 and RCP 8.5. Too much jargons. So basically, we have run two scenarios. The first one is the worst-case scenario, where the economic cost of Australia's failure to mitigate climate change. And in the second scenario, the economic future under green economic growth and net zero mitigation pathway adopted by Australia. By the way, these animations, they just reflect how would Australia look like under worst-case scenario by 2100. Let's quickly talk about RCP. That stands for Representative Concentration Pathway. It helps understand how climate may change by the year 2100 under different emission levels. So let's start with RCP 8.5. That's the worst case scenario. So basically, we rely on fossil fuels for power generation. Most of the time, people use regular vehicles, combustion vehicles for transport. So by 2100, the world temperature is expected to rise by 4 degrees Celsius, and the sea level by roughly 0.6 meters. Whereas RCP 2.6 is like the dream world scenario, cuckoo land scenario. I mean, like, most of the electricity is, power is being generated by renewable sources, and people are relying on other sustainable modes of transport. So by 2100, the world temperature will only rise by 1 degree Celsius, or the sea level by 0.4 meter. So let's talk about the results. So under the worst case scenario, if we have assumed Australia and rest of the world has failed to adopt or failed to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change. So we have seen that there's a significant reduction in Australia's GDP. In fact, there's a reduction in GDP across all major states of Australia. On the other hand, scenario two, we assumed Australia and rest of the world adopted a coordinated strategy towards net zero mitigation pathway. So initially, there was a reduction in GDP, but over time, there was an increase in GDP across all states of Australia. That's the second half of my presentation. So due to lack of time, I would just walk you through with the methodology and approach. So basically, we have applied CGE to assess the effectiveness of two important flood mitigation measures, the buyback and the infrastructure investment, which is levees and dams. So the primary goal of the buyback policy is to remove the highest risk dwellings completely, whereas infrastructure, it reduces flood depth and frequency across the whole town. In terms of unit cost, so roughly a replacement cost of the buyback cost of a house in Lismore and Northern River is about 500,000. So let's say the government ends up buying 1,000 houses, so you can work out the cost. Whereas, let's say if the government invests in a levy, so generally a levy costs about $1.2 billion. However, it impacts nearly 12,000 homes on average. So the average cost of levy is about $100,000 per house. And then in terms of coverage, the buyback policy affects less than 0.5% of the houses. That's it. So it doesn't really impact the home, the quoted premium. I mean, the premium that is quoted by various insurance companies. So it just has no effect. Whereas for levies, it impacts like 90% of the houses in a town, as well as the public infrastructure and various other social infrastructure. So, and based on the historical data we have seen, if a levy is successful, Insurance companies are able to reduce the premium by 40 to 60%. They just technically remove the loading, the flood loading from the home insurance premium. In order to do this simulation, we divided Australia into three main groups, the low-risk region, medium-risk, and the high-risk flood region. So technically, any house that falls under the high-risk region, we would suggest the government to just buy back those houses. There's just no point of providing cover to a house that is being washed away every year. That was the case in Lismores. And in the medium-risk houses, so basically what's going on is their flood issue would be tackled through infrastructure development. And of course, the low-risk houses, that's where the majority lies. They'll be funding the two mitigation measures. In the flood analysis, we have taken into account the four different sources of flood, which is flash flooding, riverine, tidal, and storm surge. I just thought to come up with some animation. It's a lot easier to visualize rather than just explain in words the differences. And beside this, we have introduced a probabilistic flood model. So that takes into account the uncertainty and outputs, distribution of likelihood for a flood to occur. So basically the model takes into account the previous history of flooding in that particular area, other factors like proximity to water, elevation, and if there are any levees or dams, like any useful infrastructure to mitigate flood. So it analyzes a specific probability starting from 0.1% all the way up to 50% to create hazard layers. It shows where and how deep flooding could occur for each probability. It not only calculates, but also maps flood risk for different probabilities within a year. Before jumping onto this slide, I might share one thing. Yeah. So back in 2022, there was one guy that caught a lot of attention. He was basically wearing a shirt, just a plain shirt with something written on it. It said that I survived 3 1-in-100-year floods in 2 years. So, yeah, it does ring a bell, right? Isn't it? So this is 1% AEP standard currently in place, but data suggests that homes built above this level are sustaining a significant level of damage. So the councils, local governments need to improve the building and land use planning codes and other policies to reduce the flood damages. That's a house located in Lismore that lodged a massive, massive claim, but sadly it got rejected. So generally, on average, the houses in Northern River and Lismore, they are built at a height. So the planning, and that's a sort of a requirement now. And if they want to get home insurance coverage, and of course, I think the council will only give the permission if the house is built at a certain height. So the planning level of this house was 16 meters. And interestingly, as we saw, right, the height of the flood itself was 14 meters. So nearly the whole ground level was flooded. Ideally, on the ground level of these houses in Lismore, it can only be used as a garage purposes, perhaps as a laundry, and at most a rumpus room. That's it. But we Australians love decorating our houses. We just put all sorts of furniture into that room. And once it's struck by a flood or any other catastrophe, we lodge, we try to claim everything from the insurance company, but sadly, it gets denied because the purpose is not for regular living purposes. So I've got a few questions for the audience. Should the council ensure that the ground level must not be used for living purposes? Should coverage be provided for houses below the planning level? Should people who build above the planning level get affordable insurance? So these are the sort of questions that insurance companies are trying to answer, the councils are trying to answer, but they haven't really come up with any proper guideline yet, and that's causing the Senate and in other inquiry commissions that we have been seeing after these floods. So that's pretty much end of the slides. So the purpose of this presentation was, of course, to familiarize you with a major issue in the home insurance market, especially after the March 22 floods. And most importantly, it was to introduce you to a new technique, CGE, which I believe like CGI modeling offers actuaries a powerful tool to understand the broader economic impact of insurance-related decisions, policies, and risk. So by capturing interactions across sectors, households, and governments, CGI model allows actuaries to go beyond firm-level analysis and evaluate how shocks such as climate change, regulatory reforms, or natural disasters affect premium, insurance demand, and other macroeconomic outcomes. So, yeah, that's something that's an add-on to our FCR or DFA analysis. Cool. I've also come up with a small demo of the CGE modeling. Like, given we have got a good picture now, what's the benefit of this model? So I just thought to quickly walk you through with a small. It's a very mini workshop. So the simulation that we are running is climate-driven uptake of home insurance in Australia. So the primary objective of this workshop is to quantify how escalating climate risk manifested through more frequent and severe flood events influencing Australian households' demand for home insurance cover and in turn affect the structure and performance of both insurance sector and the broader economy. Yeah, too much words. Alrighty, so... No, maybe if I can have the mic. Yeah, I think that'll be a lot easier. Yeah, I should have asked earlier. Beautiful. So like any process, it has got three stages, input, model, and the output. So let's start with the input. Oops. So here's the list of commodities that we have incorporated in the model, starting from crops, livestock, forest, mining, all the way down to trade, hotel, cafe, transport, and over here on number 30, we have got home insurance. Then we have got about 38 different industries. So technically, we have adopted a one-to-one relation. I mean, like, each industry produces one commodity. Of course, we can add complexity to it, but I'm just trying to run the simplest possible model here. Then here we have got roughly 97 different occupations. All the data has been acquired from ABS. Then that's the margins. So that's, you can see it as logistics or freight cost. And then that's an indicator to what extent a particular commodity has been produced locally. So let's say 21% for non-metallic minerals, so like roughly 21% has been produced locally. If you look at construction or insurance, that's mostly produced locally. And over here, 1 BAS is your industry output. 2 BAS is like your investment. 3 BAS is like your household's consumption. 4 BAS is your exports. So it's basically the macroeconomic equation of GDP, household plus household consumption plus investments plus government expenditure and the net exports. Then we have got the associated margins and then the associated tax. Here are the factors of production, capital, labor, and land, production tax, and other cost. And we have got elasticities as well, like sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3. These are like Armington elasticity. Armington was a mathematician. So we picked up an approach to drive these elasticities. Alrighty, so now the second step is the model. So I'll just quickly... So it's close to like 3,000 lines. I can't walk you through with everything over here. So just a few bits and pieces. So like we kick off by like setting up all the sets, like commodity sources, either it's domestic or imported, industries, occupations. Then we talk about the margins. And then the basic flow of the commodities. Then we talk about the taxes. Then the factors of production. Then the purchaser's price. Purchaser's price is simply the actual cost of the output plus your margins plus taxes. Maybe I can quickly walk you through with the simulation. So we have run a short-run simulation and in the long-run simulation. Basically, in the short-run, what happens is your household consumption is fixed, investment, government expenditure, the number of firms in the market,
and the capital, the factor of production capital, is all fixed, whereas in the long run, we have made all these items or variables variable. We have assumed due to the recent catastrophic floods, the demand for home insurance has increased by roughly 10%. So now maybe I'll show you the results. There's just heaps and heaps of numbers. So that's the domestic consumption. We can see after running this deterministic simulation, the consumption of home insurance, both in short run and long run, have increased by roughly 9% and 15% in the long run. The reason it has increased a lot higher in the long run is because of flow-on effect. There's economies of scale, more firms can enter into the market. And if you can see, for all other commodities, it has reduced marginally. I mean, people are squeezing their incomes from other commodities and investing more in the home insurance cover. If you look at the domestic output, for home insurance has risen by roughly 10%, both in short run and in the long run. Whereas in the short run, we noticed that the number of firms are fixed. So you can't really, of course, there's a shortfall of a supply, right? And there's an increased demand, but the amount of policies that an insurance company can write is fixed. So technically, through MGAs and other different ways, the coverage, whereas in the long run, we have got more firms in the market, thus overall supply expands, and the cost of providing the cover also reduces. So we have seen the demand for imports has significantly reduced. If I quickly show you the prices. In the short run, there was a significant increase in the demand, so the prices rose by roughly 1.4%, whereas in the long run, because of the producers have conquered the cost factor and there's economies of scale expansion in the supply, so the overall price of the home insurance has dropped. And maybe I can show you a few macro variables. So the government tax revenue, it has improved. Of course, when the demand increases, the sales increases, and eventually the tax revenue. In the short run, the insurance companies were making a lot of profit as well. And we also observed an increase in employment. So yeah. So at the end of the day, the CGE modeling allows you to do such holistic sort of analysis. Apparently that's the motive of today's presentation, to walk you through with a completely new technique. There are heaps of numbers. Of course, you can't do justice, right? I can't provide a thorough rundown in a matter of few minutes, but the goal of today's presentation was just to quickly walk you through, how does the overall modeling process looks like, the code behind it, the various simulations in the data set. Cool. That's pretty much it. Thank you.
I encourage you to use the app to type in your question. Maybe I'll just start off with the first one. I can see the CGE technique as a really useful tool, especially when it comes to the government planning,
yep.
Given they've got limited budget to invest in risk mitigation. Yep. So you can see how they can get the benefit out of it. So is there any way when it comes to then insurance products or the home insurance policies that you can find some kind of sweet spot where you actually can encourage people to take up more insurance? Because at the moment, some of these areas, the problem is actually around non-insurance,
yep.
or under-insurance.
CGE, as I said, is a simulation tool. So we need to add various inputs to the model. One way that I can suggest is we can actually divide Australia into multiple regions depending upon the risk. Of course, we can make a good use of the information that's available on ICA platform. So
Then at the end of the day, then basically CG would actually help us identify the sweet spots where insurance companies can actually find the good risk. And yeah, and I think that's the second part of my research, to like the high flood prone regions that are, that we discovered in this modeling process, to come up with a mix actually. Like there's no single solution. We might need to come up with a mix, like a pool, like ARPC, sort of a pool for home insurance market, and then followed by a combination of buyback and infrastructure development. Yeah. Something on those lines, if I'm getting towards your question.
Okay. I've got a few questions here. So, okay, we've got 10 minutes, I think. Okay, next question. There evidently are a lot of assumptions and inputs to these models. Where do these come from, and how sensitive are the outputs to these assumptions?
So there are a couple of sources for the input. The main data, like the GDP, all the macroeconomic information is coming from ABS, which is a open source secondary information. Whereas the assumptions, let's say elasticities, the level of the proportion of the commodities that are domestic or non-domestic, that's the sort of assumption, that's where the actuarial judgment or some sort of judgment comes into play. And of course we can find various literature with, let's say we want to set up elasticity for some products, there may be some products that are highly elastic. So that's where we also take into account literature, but the base, the majority of the data comes from ABS, and that's what makes this model easy to use. I mean, if not easy to use, it's easily accessible because you are relying on public information, and it's easy to explain as well. Yeah.
There's another question here. Where did we get the dependency structures between everything? Are these assumed to be linear? What are some of the statistical distributional assumptions? For example, yearly changes in FX rates, the interest rate. Then afterwards, is it an MC Monte Carlo simulation?
Yeah. So again, like in order to work out the probability or the likelihood of floods, that's where we have adopted a probabilistic flood model. So different inputs are coming from different approaches, right? So with regards to the changing interest rates, that's where we add a stochastic element. We try, like we do long-term liability forecast for workers' comp and other portfolios. So we need a long view, a broader view of interest rates and future inflation assumption. So that's the sort of approach we adopt over here. Maybe like a regression-based approach, or maybe we can come up with a more stochastic approach, but over here I adopted a more regression-based approach. And with regards to the frequency and the average claim size of the floods, that's where we adopted Monte Carlo. And it's majorly a deterministic model, but the assumption that flows into the model, they are sort of a stochastic, or it depends how you come up. Either you're picking up directly from the literature or you're adopting a stochastic model behind it. Cheers.
This last question, it says, what's your answer to the three questions?
Alrighty, cool, thanks. Yeah, so yeah, like at the end of the day, the goal was to walk you through with a completely new approach and encourage actuaries to adopt this technique, and going forward, like I'm hoping, like once I'm able to finish my PhD, which hopefully very soon, then I'll be organizing talks and sessions on how to build up CG modeling and like how we can actually bring it into our profession. Basically, like we are getting into analytic space, AI space, but I think we haven't yet been able to find the business value or able to link it with business problems. But with respect to CG, it's a well-established model. It's being used by Deloitte and a couple of other major consulting companies for a very long time, but for government projects. And we are trying to introduce it into the actuarial space. And yeah, so maybe at some point, I'll be starting on some workshops just to familiarize actuaries with this new technique. Yeah, cheers. Cool.
Okay. Any other questions from the floor?
Cool. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of the evening.
Thank you.